The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassed 10, Side 2.
But socialists were just the people who were used to receiving their food without payment in exile. Because the Soviet government did not dare to break this tradition immediately, its treasury also began paying political exiles, only, of course, not all of them, not the KRs, counter-revolutionaries, but the socialist polits, making some gradations among them. For instance, in Chimkent in 1927, SRs and SDs were given 6 rubles a month, and Trotskyites 30. They were still comrades, after all, still Bolsheviks. Only these were no longer Tsarist rubles. The rent for the smallest of rooms was 10 rubles a month, and 20 kopecks a day bought only meagre fare. As time went by, things were harder. By 1933, they were paying the polits a grant of 6 rubles, 25, a month. But in that year, as I myself very well remember, a kilogram of half-baked commercial rye bread, off the ration, cost 3 rubles. There was one thing left for the socialists, not language teaching, not writing theoretical works, but back-breaking work. From those who did go to work, the GPU immediately took away whatever miserable allowance they were still receiving. However, even if they were willing to work, it was not so easy for exiles to earn a wage. The end of the 20s is, of course, memorable as a period of high unemployment in our country. Getting a job was the prerogative of persons with unblemished records and trade union cards, and exiles could not compete by exhibiting their education and experience. They also had the local police headquarters hanging menacingly over them. Without its permission, no employer would ever dare take on an exile. Even a former exile had little hope of a good job. The brand in his passport was an impediment. In Kazan in 1934, as P.S. Blank V.A. remembers, a group of educated exiles in desperation hired themselves out as road makers. They were rebuked by police headquarters. What was the meaning of this demonstration? But no one offered to help them find other work, and Grigory B. paid the security officer in his own coin. "Haven't you got a nice little trial coming up? We could sign on as paid witnesses." They had to count every crumb twice. This was what the Russian political exile system had come to. No time left for debate or for writing protests against the credo. One worry they were free from was how to cope with senseless idleness. Their one concern now was how to avoid dying of hunger, and how not to let themselves down by becoming stoolies. In the first Soviet years, in a land freed at last from age-old slavery, the pride and independence of political exiles sagged like a punctured balloon. It turned out that the strength which the previous regime had uneasily acknowledged in political prisoners was imaginary. What had created and maintained that strength was only public opinion in the country. Once public opinion was supplanted by organized opinion, the exiles, with their protests and their rights, were helplessly subjected to the tyranny of stupid, flustered GPU men and inhuman secret instructions. Dzerzhinsky lived long enough to set his hand to the first of these instructions. A single hoarse cry, one strangled word, to remind the free of your existence was now impossible. If an exiled worker sent a letter to his old factory, the worker who read it out, as Vasily Kirillovich Yegoshin did in Leningrad, was immediately exiled himself. Exiles now lost not only monetary allowances, the means of existence, but all rights whatsoever the GPU could get at them to prolong their banishment, arrest them, or transport them even more easily than when they were supposed to be free, uninhibitedly treat them like rubber dolls rather than people. Those Western socialists who waited till 1967 to feel ashamed of being socialists side by side with the Soviet Union could very well have come to that conclusion some 40 or 45 years earlier. At that time, Russian communists were already destroying Russian socialists. But nobody groans when another man's tooth aches. Nothing was easier than to shake them up by means such as those once used in Chimkent. It was announced that the exiled colony was to be wound up within 24 hours. In 24 hours, the exiles had to hand over any business in which they were engaged, pull down their houses, get rid of their household goods, make their preparations for the journey, and set off by a prescribed route. It was not much easier than being a transported prisoner. Nor was the exile's future much more certain. But forgetting for a moment the silence of the public and the heavy pressures of the GPU, what were the exiles themselves like, these party members, so-called, without parties? I'm not thinking of the cadets. There were no cadets left. They had all been done to death. But asking what it meant by 1927 or 1930 to be nominally an SR or a Menshevik. Nowhere in the country were there any active groups corresponding to these names. For a long time now, ever since the revolution, in 10 storm-fraught years, their programs had not been re-examined, and even if these parties had suddenly risen from the dead, nobody knew how they would interpret all that had happened and what they would propose. For a long time now, the whole press had mentioned them only in the past tense, and surviving members lived with their families, worked at their jobs, and thought no more about their parties. But names, once inscribed in the tablets of the GPU, are indelible. At a sudden nocturnal signal, these scattered rabbits were plucked from their burrows and transported via transit jails to, for instance, Bukhara. Thus, I.V. Stolyarov arrived there in 1930 to meet aging SRs and SDs gathered in from all corners of the country. Rudely snatched from the lives they were used to, they had nothing better to do than begin arguing and assessing the current political situation and speculating what course history would have taken if only, and if only. So, their enemies knocked together from them not, of course, a political party, but a target for sinking. Exiles of the 20s recall that the only live and militant party at that time was the Zionist Socialist Party, with its vigorous youth organization, Hashomer, and its legal Hehalutz organization, which existed to establish Jewish agrarian communes in the Crimea. In 1926, the whole Central Committee was jailed, and in 1927, indomitably cheerful boys and girls of 15, 16 and under were taken from the Crimea and exiled. They were sent to Tyrtkul and other strict places. This really was a party, close-knit, determined, sure that its cause was just. Their aim, however, was not one which all could share, but private and particular, to live as a nation in a Palestine of their own. The Communist Party, which had voluntarily disowned its fatherland, could not tolerate narrow nationalism in others. It might be supposed that this natural and noble aspiration of the Zionists to recreate the land of their ancestors, to confirm the faith of their ancestors, and reassemble there after 3,000 years of diaspora, would elicit the united support and aid at least of the European peoples. Admittedly, a national home in the Crimea was not the Zionist idea in its purest form, and perhaps it was Stalin's joke to invite this Mediterranean people to adopt Birobidzhan, on the edge of the Taiga, as their second Palestine. He was a great master of slow and secret scheming, and perhaps this kind invitation was a rehearsal for the exile which he would have in mind for them in 1953. Mutual aid was still practiced among the exiles until the beginning of the 30s. Thus, SR, SD, and anarchist exiles in Chimkent, where work was easy to find, set up a secret mutual aid fund to help their workless northern party comrades. Communal arrangements for the preparation of food and the care of children, and all the gatherings and exchanges of visits which naturally go with this, were still found in places. They still joined together to celebrate May Day, there in exile, while demonstratively refusing to observe the anniversary of the October Revolution. But as the 30s reached their climax, all this would disappear. Everywhere, the buzzard's eye of the secret police would fix on exiles meeting in groups. Prisoners would begin to shun one another in case the NKVD suspected them of organizing, and pick them up on a new charge. This fate awaited them anyhow. Thus, in the pale of exile marked out by the state, they would withdraw into a second voluntary exile, into solitude. This, for the present, would be just what Stalin wanted of them. The exiles were further weakened by the estrangement of the local population. The local people were persecuted for showing friendship to exiles. Offenders were themselves exiled to other places, and youngsters expelled from the Komsomol. They were still further weakened by the unfriendly relations between parties which developed in the Soviet period and became particularly acute from the mid-20s, when large numbers of Trotskyites, who acknowledged no one but themselves as politicals, suddenly appeared in exile. But it was, of course, not only socialists who were kept in exile in the 20s. Most of the exiles, in fact, and this was truer with every year that passed, were not socialists at all. There was an influx of non-party intellectuals, those spiritually independent people who were making it difficult for the new regime to establish itself firmly. And of former people, that is, members of the pre-revolutionary establishment, not destroyed in the Civil War. And even of young boys, for fox-trotting. And spiritualists, and occultists, and clerics, at first with the right to conduct services in exile. And simply believers, simply Christians, or Christiane, peasants, to use the word as modified by the Russians many centuries ago. They all came under the eye of the same security police sector, were divided from each other, and grew numb. Robbed of all strength by the indifference of the country at large, the exiles lost even the will to escape. For exiles in Tsarist times, escaping was a merry sport. Think of Stalin's 5 or Nogin's 6 escapes. The threat hanging over them was not a bullet, not katorga, but merely being resettled in their old place of exile after a diverting journey. But the MVD, as it grew more stupid and heavy-handed, from the mid-20s imposed collective responsibility on exiles belonging to the same party. If one of you runs away, all his party comrades will answer for him. By now the air was so stifling, the pressures so overbearing, that the socialists, so recently proud and indomitable, accepted this responsibility. They themselves, in party resolutions, forbade themselves to escape. Where, in any case, could they run? To whom could they run? Was there a people to whom they might run? Specialists in theoretical rationalization deftly put foundations under the decision. This is not the right time to run away. We must wait. In fact, it was not the right time to fight at all. Again, they must wait. At the beginning of the 30s, N.Y. Mandelstam noted that socialist exiles in Chertinsk utterly refused to resist, even when they sensed that their destruction was inevitable. Their only practical hope was an extension of their term of banishment, so long as they were not arrested, and were allowed to sign on again there on the spot. Then at least their modestly comfortable existence would not be ruined. Their only moral aim was to preserve their human dignity in the face of destruction. It is strange for us, after Katorga, where we changed from crushed and isolated individuals into a powerful whole, to learn that these socialists, once an articulated whole, tried and proved in action, disintegrated and became helpless units. But in the last 2 decades, our life as social beings has steadily expanded, filled out. We are inhaling. Then it was just as steadily contracting, shrinking under pressure. We were exhaling. So that it is unseemly for our age to judge that other. There were, moreover, many different degrees of severity in the treatment of exiles, and this, too, disunited and weakened them. The intervals at which identity cards were exchanged varied. For some it was monthly, and the formalities were excruciatingly slow. Unless you didn't care about sinking to the lowest category, you had to observe the rules. The mildest form of banishment also survived until the beginning of the 30s. This was not exile, but free residence minus. In this case, the person penalized, the minusnik, was not told to live in one specified place, but allowed to choose any town, with certain exceptions, or minuses. Once having chosen, he was tied to that place for the same 3-year period. The minusnik did not have to report regularly to the GPU, but did not have the right to leave the area. In years of widespread unemployment, labour exchanges would not give a minusnik work if he can try to find himself a job. Pressure was put on the management to dismiss him. The minus pinned the dangerous insect down, and it submissively waited its turn to be arrested properly. Then again, people still believed in a progressive order which could not and would not need to exile citizens. Believed in an amnesty, especially as the splendid 10th anniversary of October drew near. The amnesty came, the amnesty struck. They started reducing terms of banishment by a quarter, 3-year sentences by 9 months, and that not for everyone. But since the great game of patience was being laid out, and the 3 years of exile were followed by 3 years in a political isolation prison, followed in turn by another 3 years in exile, this acceleration of the process by 3 months did nothing to make life more beautiful. Then it would be time for the next trial. The anarchist Dmitry Venediktov, toward the end of his 3-year exile in Tobolsk, 1937, was arrested, and the charge against him was categorical and precise. Disseminating rumours about loans. What can they have meant by rumours when the loan comes around each year as infallibly as the flowers in May? And dissatisfaction with the Soviet regime. An exile, of course, should be content with his lot. And what happened to him next for these obscene crimes? He was sentenced to be shot within 72 hours, with no right of appeal. His surviving daughter, Galina, has already made a brief appearance in the pages of this book. We have seen what exile meant in the first years of newly won freedom, and seen, too, the only way of escaping completely. Exile was a temporary pen to hold sheep marked for slaughter. Exiles in the first Soviet decades were not meant to settle, but to await the summons elsewhere. There were clever people, former people, and also some simple peasants, who already realized in the 20s all that lay before them. And when they reached the end of their first 3-year term, they stayed exactly where they were, in Archangel, for instance, just in case. Sometimes this helped them not to be caught under the knit comb again. This was what exile had become in our time, instead of the peace and quiet of Shushenskoye or cocoa drinking in Turukan. You will see that we had heavier burdens than Ovid's homesickness to bear. Chapter 2. The Peasant Plague. This chapter will deal with a small matter. 15 million souls, 15 million lives. They weren't educated people, of course. They couldn't play the violin. They didn't know who Meyerhold was, or how interesting it is to be a nuclear physicist. In the First World War, we lost in all 3 million killed. In the second, we lost 20 million. So Khrushchev said, according to Stalin, it was only 7 million. Was Nikita being too generous, or couldn't Yosef keep track of his capital? All those odes, all those obelisks and eternal flames, those novels and poems, for a quarter of a century all Soviet literature has been drunk on that blood. But about the silent, treacherous plague which starved 15 millions of our peasants to death, choosing its victims carefully and destroying the backbone and mainstay of the Russian people, about that plague, there are no books. No bugles bid our hearts beat faster for them. Not even the traditional 3 stones mark the crossroads where they went in creaking carts to their doom. Our finest humanists, so sensitive to today's injustices, in those years only nodded approvingly. Quite right, too, just what they deserve. It was all kept so dark, every stain so carefully scratched out, every whisper so swiftly choked, that whereas I now have to refuse kind offers of material on the camps, no more, my friends, I have masses of such stories, I don't know where to put them. Nobody brings me a thing about the deported peasants. Who is the person that could tell us about them? Where is he? I know all too well that what is wanted here is not a chapter, nor even a book by one single man, and I cannot document even one chapter thoroughly. All the same, I shall make a beginning, set my chapter down as a marker like those first stones, simply to mark the place where the new temple of Christ the Saviour will some day be raised. Where did it all start? With the dogma that the peasantry is petit bourgeois? And who, in the eyes of these people, is not petit bourgeois? In their wonderfully clear-cut scheme, apart from factory workers, not the skilled workers, though, and big-shot businessmen, all the rest, the whole people, peasants, office workers, actors, airmen, professors, students, doctors, are nothing but the petite bourgeoisie. Or did it start with a criminal scheme in high places to rob some and terrorize the rest? From the last letters which Korolenko wrote to Gorky in 1921, just before the former died and the latter emigrated, we learn that this villainous assault on the peasantry had begun even then, and was taking almost the same form as in 1930. But as yet their strength did not equal their impudence, and they backed down. The plan, however, remained in their heads, and all through the 20s they bullied and prodded and taunted. Kulak, kulak, kulak! The thought that it was impossible to live in the same world as the kulak was gradually built up in the minds of townspeople. The devastating peasant plague began, as far as we can judge, in 1929, the compilation of murder lists, the confiscations, the deportations. But only at the beginning of 1930, after rehearsals were complete and necessary adjustments made, was the public allowed to learn what was happening in the decision of the Central Committee of the Party dated January the 5th. The party is justified in shifting from a policy of restricting the exploiting tendencies of the kulaks to a policy of liquidating the kulaks as a class. And the admission of kulaks to the Kolkhoz was immediately prohibited. Would anyone like to attempt a coherent explanation? The dutifully concurring Central Executive Committee of the Soviets and the Council of People's Commissars were not far behind the Central Committee, and on February the 1st, 1930, they gave legislative form to the will of the party. Provincial executive committees were required to use all necessary methods in the struggle with the kulaks up to and including, in reality no other method was used, complete confiscation of the property of kulaks and their removal to points beyond the boundaries of certain regions and provinces. Only in those last words was the butcher overcome with shame. He specified from which boundaries, but he did not say to which. If you were inattentive enough, you could take it to mean 30 versts away in the same neighborhood. In the vanguard doctrine, as far as I know, there was no such person as the henchman of kulaks, but as soon as the party put its hand to the mowing machine, there was obviously no doing without him. We have seen already what the word is worth. A sack collection was announced. Young pioneers went from hut to hut, collecting from the peasants on behalf of the indigent state. You wouldn't give up your sack because it was like parting with your lifeblood. There were none in the shops, of course. And there you were, a henchman of the kulaks, ripe for deportation. Names like this rampaged through a Soviet Russia with the bloody exhalations of the Civil War still warm in its nostrils. Words were put into circulation, and although they meant nothing, they were easily remembered. They simplified matters. They made thought completely unnecessary. The savage law of the Civil War, 10 for everyone, 100 for everyone, was reinforced, to my mind, an un-Russian law. Where will you find anything like it in Russian history? For every activist, which usually meant big-mouthed loafer, A.Y. Olenyev is not the only one to recall that thieves and drunkards were in charge of de-kulakization. For every activist killed in self-defense, hundreds of the most industrious, enterprising and level-headed peasants, those who should keep the Russian nation on an even keel, were eliminated. Yells of indignation. What's that? What do you say? What about the bloodsuckers, those who squeezed their neighbors dry? Take your loan and pay me back with your hide. I suppose the bloodsuckers were a small part of the whole number, but were all the bloodsuckers there among them? And were they bloodsuckers born, we may ask? Bloodsuckers through and through, or was it just that all wealth and all power corrupts human beings? If only the cleansing of mankind or of a socialist state were so simple. But if they had cleansed the peasantry of heartless bloodsuckers with their fine-toothed iron comb, cheerfully sacrificing 15 millions for the purpose. Whence all those vicious, fat-bellied rednecks who preside over collectivized villages and district party committees today? Those pitiless oppressors of lonely old women and all defenseless people? How was the root of this predatory weed missed during de-kulakization? Surely, heaven help us, they can't have sprung from the activists. He who grew up robbing banks could not think about the peasantry either as a brother or as a husbandman. He could only whistle like Nightingale the robber, and millions of toiling peasants were dragged off to the taiga, horny-handed tillers of the soil, the very same who had set up the Soviet power simply to get land, and having obtained it, quickly tightened their grip on it. The land belongs to those who work it. The word bloodsuckers loses all resonance. The tongue that uses it is a clapper in a wooden bell. When we remember what a clean sweep they made of some villages in the Kuban, Uropinskaya, for instance. They deported every soul in it, from babes in arms to aged men, and resettled it with demobilized soldiers. Here we see clearly what the class principle really meant. Let us remember that the Kuban gave hardly any support to the whites in the Civil War, began of its own accord to wreck Denikin's supply lines, and sought agreement with the Reds. Then, suddenly, there they were, the saboteurs of the Kuban. The village of Dolinka, renowned throughout the archipelago as a prosperous agricultural center, where did it come from? All its inhabitants were Germans, de-kulakized and deported in 1929. Who had been exploiting whom is a mystery. The principle underlying de-kulakization can also be clearly seen in the fate of the children. Take Shurka Dmitriev from the village of Masleno, Selishchensky Kadzalmi, near the Volkhov. He was 13 when his father, Fyodor, died in 1925, and the only son in a family of girls, who was to manage his father's holding. Shurka took it on. The girls and his mother accepted him as head of the family. A working peasant and an adult now, he exchanged bows with other adults in the street. He was a worthy successor to his hard-working father, and when 1929 came, his bins were full of grain. Obviously, a kulak. The whole family was driven out. Adamovo Sliotsberg has a moving story about meeting a girl called Motya, who was jailed in 1936 for leaving her place of banishment without permission to go to her native village, Svetlovidovo, near Tarusa, 2,000 kilometers on foot. Sportsmen are given medals for that sort of thing. She had been exiled with her parents in 1929 when she was a little schoolgirl and deprived of schooling forever. Her teacher's pet name for her was Motya, our little Edison. The child, who was not only an excellent pupil, but had an inventive turn of mind, had rigged up a sort of turbine worked by a stream, and invented other things for the school. After 7 years, she felt an urge to look just once more at the log walls of her unattainable school, and for that, little Edison went to prison and then to a camp. Did any child suffer such a fate in the 19th century? Every miller was automatically a candidate for de-kulakization, and what were millers and blacksmiths but the Russian village's best technicians? Take the miller Prokop Ivanovich Laktyonkin from the Ryazan region. No sooner was he de-kulakized than they ground the millstones together too hard and burned the mill down. After the war, he was pardoned and returned to his native village, but he could not reconcile himself to the fact that there was no mill. Laktyonkin obtained permission, cast the grinders himself, and set up a mill on the same spot. It had to be the same spot. Not for his own profit, but for the Kolkhoz, or rather because the neighborhood was incomplete and less beautiful without it. Now let us look at that other kulak, the village blacksmith. In fact, we'll start with his father, as personnel departments like to do. His father, Gordei Vasilievich, served for 25 years in the Warsaw garrison, and earned enough silver to make a tin button. This soldier, with 25 years' service, was denied a plot of land. He had married a soldier's daughter while he was in the garrison, and after his discharge he went to his wife's native place, the village of Barsuki, in the Krasnensky district. The village got him tipsy, and he paid off its tax arrears with half of his savings. With the other half, he leased a mill from a landowner, but quickly lost the rest of his money in this venture. He spent his long old age as a herdsman and watchman. He had 6 daughters, all of whom he gave in marriage to poor men, and an only son, Trifon. Their family name was Trvardovsky. The boy was sent away to serve in a haberdasher's shop, but fled back to Barsuki and found employment with the Molchanovs, who had the forge. After a year as an unpaid labourer, and 4 years as an apprentice, he became a smith himself, built a wooden house in the village of Zagoria, and married. 7 children were born, among them Alexander the poet. And no one is likely to get rich from a forge. The oldest son, Konstantin, helped his father. If they smelted and hammered from one dawn to the next, they could make 5 excellent steel axes. But the smiths of Roslavl, with their presses and their hard workmen, undercut their price. In 1929, their forge was still wood-built. They had only one horse. Sometimes they had a cow and a calf. Sometimes neither a cow nor calf. And besides all this, they had 8 apple trees. You can see what bloodsuckers they were. The peasant land bank used to sell mortgaged estates on deferred payments. Trifon Tvardovsky had taken 11 desiatins of waste land, all overgrown with bushes, and the year of the plague found them still sweating and straining to clear it. They had brought 5 desiatins into cultivation, and the rest they abandoned to the bushes. The collectivizers marked them down for dekulakization. There were only 15 households in the village, and somebody had to be found. They assessed the income from the forge at a fantastic figure, imposed a tax beyond the family's means, and when it was not paid on time, "Get ready to move, you damned kulaks, you!" If a man had a brick house in a row of log cabins, or 2 stories in a row of 1-story houses, there was your kulak. "Get ready, you bastard, you've got 60 minutes. There aren't supposed to be any brick houses in the Russian village. There aren't supposed to be 2-story houses. Back to the cave. You don't need a chimney for your fire. This is our great plan for transforming the country. History has never seen the like of it." But we still have not reached the innermost secret. The better off were sometimes left where they were, provided they joined the Kolkhoz quickly, while the obstinate poor peasant who failed to apply was deported. This is very important, the most important thing. The point of it all was not to de-kulakize, but to force the peasants into the Kolkhoz. Without frightening them to death, there was no way of taking back the land which the revolution had given them, and planting them on that same land as serfs. It was a second civil war, this time against the peasants. It was indeed the great turning point, or, as the phrase had it, the great break. Only we're never told what it was that broke. It was the backbone of Russia. No, we have been unfair to socialist realist writers. They have described the dekulakization, described it very fluently too, and with great feeling for its heroes, as though they were hunters of snarling wolves. But there are no descriptions of the long village street with every house in the row boarded up, or of how you could walk through a village and see on the steps of a peasant house a dead woman with a dead child in her lap, or an old man sitting under a fence who asked you for bread, and when you walked back he had collapsed and died. Nor shall we read in their works scenes like this. The chairman of the village Soviet, taking the schoolteacher as a witness, goes into a hut where an old man and an old woman are lying on the sleeping bench. The old man used to keep a tea house, obviously a bloodsucker. Who says wayfarers are glad of hot tea? He brandishes his revolver. "Get down, you Tambov wolf!" The old woman starts howling, and the chairman fires at the ceiling to intimidate them still more. The gun makes a very loud noise in a peasant hut. Both these old people died on their journey. Still less will you read about this method of dekulakization. All the Cossacks, we are in a village on the Don, were summoned to a meeting, and there, surrounded with machine guns, arrested and driven away. Deporting their women later on was simplicity itself. We can find described in books, or even see in films, barns and pits in the ground, full of grain hoarded by bloodsuckers. What they won't show us is the handful of belongings earned in a lifetime of toil, the livestock, the utensils, things as close to the owner as her own skin, which a weeping peasant woman is ordered to leave forever. If some of the family survive and are clever and persistent enough to persuade Moscow to rehabilitate them as middle peasants, they will not find a stick of their medium property left when they return. It will have been pillaged by the activists and their women. What they will not show us are the little bundles with which the family are allowed onto the state's cart. We shall not learn that in the Twardovsky house, when the evil moment came, there was neither suet nor bread. Their neighbor Kuzma saved them. He had several children and was far from rich himself, but bought them food for the journey. Those who were quick enough fled from that plague to the towns, sometimes with a horse, but there were no customers for horses in those times. That peasant horse, sure sign of a kulak, became as bad as the plague itself. Its master would tie it to a hitching rail at the horse market, give it one last pat on the muzzle, and go away before anyone noticed. The years 1929 to 1930 are generally regarded as the years of the plague, but its deathly stink hung over the countryside long afterward. In the Kuban in 1932, all the wheat and rye to the very last grain was taken straight from the threshing machine to the state procurement point. And when the collective farmers, who had been given nothing to eat except their harvesters' and threshers' rations, found that hot dinners ended with the threshing, and that there was not a grain to come for their labour, how could the mobs of howling women be silenced? How many kulaks are there left in this place? Who should be deported? Skripnikovo's testimony enables us to judge the condition of the kulak-free countryside in the early days of the Kolkhoz. She remembers some peasant women in 1930 sending parcels of dried crusts home to their native village from Solovki. Here is the story of Timofey Pavlovich Ovchinnikov, born in 1886, from the village of Kishkino in the Mikhnevsko area, not far from Leninskiye Gorky, near the Great High Road. He fought in the German War. He fought in the Civil War. When he had finished fighting, he returned to land given by the decree and married. He was clever, literate, experienced, an excellent worker. He had also acquired, self-taught, some skill in veterinary medicine and gave a helping hand to the whole district. By tireless work, he built himself a good house, planted an orchard, and reared a colt to become a fine horse. But the NEP confused him, and Timofey Pavlovich was rash enough to believe in it as he had believed in the land decree. In partnership with another peasant, he started a little business making cheap sausages. Now that the village has been without sausage for 40 years, you may scratch your head and wonder what was so bad about that. They made the sausage themselves, used no hired labour, and indeed sold their products through a cooperative. When they had worked at it for just 2 years, 1925 to 1927, crippling tax demands were made on them, since they allegedly earned large sums. These were dreamed up by tax inspectors in the line of duty, but envious drones in the village, incapable of making anything of themselves except activists, also blew into the tax man's ear. So the partners closed down. In 1929, Timofey was one of the first to join the Kolkhoz, taking with him his good horse, his cow, and all his implements. He worked hard in the common fields, and also reared 2 steers for the Kolkhoz. The Kolkhoz began to collapse, and many walked or ran away from it, but Timofey had 5 children and was stuck. Since the tax inspector couldn't forget old scores, and Timofey was still thought to be well off, partly because of the veterinary help he had given people, even now that he was in the Kolkhoz, they pursued him with tax demands, which he could not meet. When he had no money to pay, they started coming to his house and seizing bits of clothing. Once his 11-year-old son managed to drive their last 3 ewes off and hide them from the inventory takers, but on another occasion they too were taken. When they came yet again to list his belongings, the impoverished family had nothing else left, So the shameless tax inspectors put down the rubber plants and their tubs. This was more than Timofey could stand, and he hacked the plants to pieces before their very eyes. Now, just consider the significance of his action. One, he had destroyed property no longer belonging to him but to the state. Two, he had made use of an axe in a demonstration against the Soviet state. Three, he had sought to discredit the Kolkhoz system. Just then, the Kolkhoz system in the village of Kishkino was going to pieces fast. Nobody had any faith in it or wanted to work. Half the peasants had left, and it was time to make an example of somebody. The hardened Nepman Timofey Ovchinnikov, who had wormed his way into the Kolkhoz to wreck it, was now expelled as a kulak by decision of Shokolov, chairman of the village Soviet. This was 1932, and mass deportation was over, so his wife and six children, one at the breast, were not deported, but only turned out of house and home. A year later, they made their way to Timofey and Archangel at their own expense. All the Ovchinnikovs had lived to be 80, but after a life like this, Timofey folded up at 53. What follows is not relevant to our immediate theme, but tells us a lot about our epoch. After a time, Timofey found a job in Archangel, in another closed sausage factory, where he was again one of two skilled men, this time with a manager over them. His own sausage factory had been closed as a menace to the working class, whereas this other was closed so that the workers would not know of it. They privately supplied the rulers of that northern clime with a variety of expensive sausages. Timofey himself was sometimes sent to deliver their wares to the home of the regional party secretary, Comrade Ostrin, a detached one-story house behind a high fence where Liebknecht Street meets Chumbarov-Luchinsky Street, and to the NKVD chief in the oblast, Comrade Chiron. Even in 1935, drunken Kolkhoz bosses went around the poverty-stricken village at Easter, demanding money for vodka from those peasants who still farmed their own holdings. "Give, or we'll dekulakize you. We'll deport you." They could, too, if you farmed by yourself. This was what the Great Break was all about. The journey itself, the peasants via Krukis, is something which our socialist realists do not describe at all. Get them aboard, pack them off, and that's the end of the story. Episode concluded. 3 asterisks, please. They were loaded onto carts, if they were lucky enough to be taken in the warm months, but it might be onto sledges in a cruel frost, with children of all ages, babes in arms as well. In February 1931, when hard frosts were interrupted only by blizzards, the strings of carts rolled endlessly through the village of Kochenevo, Novosibirsk Oblast, flanked by convoy troops, emerging from the snowbound steppe and vanishing into the snowbound steppe again. Even going into a peasant hut for a warm-up required special permission from the convoy, which was given only for a few minutes, so as not to hold up the cart train. Those GPU convoy troops, they're still alive, they're pensioners now. I dare say they remember it all. Or perhaps they can't remember. They all shuffled into the Narim marshes, and in those insatiable quagmires they all remained. Many of the children had already died a wretched death on the cruel journey. This was a nub of the plan. The peasants' seed must perish together with the adults. Since Herod was no more, only the vanguard doctrine has shown us how to destroy utterly, down to the very babes. Hitler was a mere disciple, but he had all the luck. His murder camps have made him famous, whereas no one has any interest in ours at all. The peasants knew what was in store for them, and if it was their good fortune to be transported through inhabited places, when they halted they would slip small children not too small to climb through windows. Kind people may help you. Beg your way in the world. It's better than dying with us. In Archangel, in the famine years of 1932 to 1933, the destitute children of resettled peasants were not given free school lunches and clothing vouchers, as were others in need. In that convoy of Don Cossacks, when the men arrested at the meeting were carried separately from their women, one woman gave birth to a child on the journey. Their rations were one glass of water a day, and 300 grams of bread, not every day. Was there a medical attendant? Need you ask? The mother had no milk and the child died on the way. Where were they to bury it? This book is continued on Cassette 11, Side 1.